How are we doing, Life Church? Oh, it is Monday night. My name is John, and I love the Monday night worship experience because you guys are a little crazier. And hey, good news. Good news, they just canceled school for tomorrow. So everybody, after worship, head to Meijer and get yourself some Cheetos because you get to sleep in tomorrow. Tonight, though, we got a little bit of work to do. This is not going to be a Cheetos message. This is a meat and potatoes message because we're on a journey together, a journey called God with Us, going through the scriptures cover to cover, trying to understand where do we each fit into God's great big story. So you picked the perfect night to be here if you're just joining us. We finished Genesis. In Hebrew, it means beginnings. And Genesis really is all about a single three verses. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. God loves us so much that even though we live in a wrecked, messy world marked by sin, in Genesis 12, he makes a promise to a man named Abraham. And he says, through you, through your seed, you are going to have a great name, a great land, become a great nation, and be a great blessing to the world. God says, through you, Abraham, through your family line, we are going to change the world. And so that's kind of the heartbeat of Genesis. And it's the first of five books called the Pentateuch, Penta 5 Tukas Scrolls. And that's part one of our series, God with Us, the Great Blessing, penned thousands of years ago by Moses. It's all about understanding this huge story that we're part of. And God is in the blessing business. He makes this promise to Abraham. It flows forward through Isaac, grandson Jacob. Jacob is stubborn, hard-headed, wrestles with his brother, wrestles with his dad, with his uncle, and finally Jacob wrestles with God. And God renames him Israel, he who wrestles with El, with God. He has 12 sons, the 12 tribes. Last week it ended with Joseph, and a family comes down from Canaan to Egypt. There's 70 people in the family of Jacob, and that's where Genesis ends. Tonight and next week, we're going to do a deep dive into the second book, Exodus. Turn to someone next to you and say, Exodus. Exodus. In Hebrew, Exodus means exit, and it is the history of God's people. It really sets the stage for the rest of the biblical narrative. Totally encourage you to take notes, check in on Facebook, post your notes there. And what we're going to see in Exodus is, well, if I had to sum it up, I would go to Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments. We'll get to that next week. But Moses is the main character. And at the mountain of God, God's people come to Mount Sinai. And in Exodus 19, God says something that basically sums up this two-week journey. In Exodus chapter 19, God looks out at all of his people. There's about 2 million of them, and he says in verse 6, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. And that's the heartbeat of the Moses story. Not just an exit, not just being rescued from slavery in Egypt and led to the promised land, but the whole journey of Exodus is God developing his people to be a light to the nations. Says you will be a movement of priests. And you know, in 2019 we think of the Catholic Church, but that's not what God was talking about. A priest is any man or woman who's a mediator. It means you stand in between someone far from God and the love of God. That's what Israel was supposed to be. The mediators who say, hey, everybody, look at God. He is awesome. He loves you. Forgiveness, passion, purpose is found in him. That's the heartbeat of Exodus, preparing a people for a greater purpose. So, 70 at the end of Genesis have gone down to Egypt, and 350 years go by until you get to Exodus chapter 1. If you've got a Bible, Bible app, dive into Exodus 1. If you've got the Bible app, by the way, on your smartphone, click on events, type in Life Church Michigan, and all the message notes show up on your smartphone. Exodus 1 takes place 350 years later. It's sort of like, you've seen the movie Gremlins back in the 80s? You got the cute little fuzzy Mogwai, Gizmo. And there's three rules for the Mogwai. You don't feed them after midnight. You definitely do not put them in direct sunlight. And then third, you do not get them wet, because Mogwai go, bing, 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 and they multiply. That's what happens with God's people in Egypt. 350 years, they are fertile myrtle, they are popping out babies, and they're 2 million strong in Exodus chapter 1. Pharaoh doesn't know what to do. It's a new Pharaoh. 350 years gone by. He doesn't realize they're God's people. He's like, all these, you know, Israelites are everywhere. And he says, they're going to overtake us. They're exceedingly mighty. So he enslaves them. He goes, hey, I want to build a skyscraper. I want to put in a water park over here. You guys do the work. Backbreaking, brutal slavery over God's people, building pyramids and things. And they are crying out for a rescuer. They are desiring someone to help. Meanwhile, Pharaoh is getting paranoid with all these baby Hebrews running around. So he signs a law that all the babies who are boys, they have to be killed. This is Exodus 1. They have to be slaughtered. It is genocide. It is against the law to have a baby male Jew. And this is an echo of what will happen hundreds of years in the future. Remember the Christmas story? Mary, Joseph, Jesus is born. And there's another ruler, another superpower, King Herod. He gets jealous, says everybody 2 years old and younger that's a male Hebrew must be slaughtered. Happened to Jesus, happens in Moses' day, because the story of Jesus is the story of Moses. Jesus is the second Moses, the greater Moses, who leads his people out of slavery into freedom. Everything in the Old Testament is a foreshadowing of the hero. Jesus is the hero of Scripture. So, they have to kill the baby boys. It's horrible, but if you look at Exodus 1, it says two Hebrew midwives reject this, and they secretly do like this underground railroad thing. They start rescuing all the baby boys, and they are completely going against, breaking the law. You know, they're just against what the Pharaoh's saying. You go to Exodus 2, the next chapter, and it says that a Levite and his wife have a baby. Levites are a big deal. We're going to learn later that they are the priests, the mediators. And so they have a baby boy. This baby boy is so cute. You ever seen a cute little baby? Oh, he's so cute. He just wants to squeeze his cheeks to grab my baby. This baby is so stinking cute. She goes, oh, he's so beautiful. He's so beautiful. And so they name him Beautiful, which in Hebrew is Moses. Moses. Moses means, it can mean two things. It means drawn out of water, but it also means beautiful. In the book of Acts, it talks about how Moses was, you know, he's on the cover of GQ. He's looking pretty good. And so you got baby boy Moses, and mom is like, I can't kill him. Older sister Miriam's like, I don't want to kill the baby. So they concoct a plan. They build a basket. They put him in the sea of reeds, float him downstream to where Pharaoh's daughter, Ivanka, rescues the baby. And she says, I can't put him to death. I know the dad said that there's a law, genocide. But I can't do this, and so I will adopt baby Moses as my own. Check this out. Two Hebrew midwives in chapter 1. Moses' mama, big sister, Pharaoh's daughter. That's five women who are saviors, rescuers. Right. And this is pretty stinking cool, because you would never tell the story of five women doing something awesome in that day, because Egyptian history, Hebrew history, women were worth spit. They were worth jack squat. They had no social standing. The only reason to tell the story of five women who did something awesome is if the story is true. If you're concocting a fake legend, you would never tell the story of these five women. So once again, you see that the scriptures are true. There's no reason to include the story unless it really happens. And in those first two chapters, you see the seeds of the ministry of a 20th century powerhouse. One of the guys I look up to for the 20th century, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Because what these five women are doing is they are enacting civil disobedience for the first time in human history. It's that idea from Exodus that spurs the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It all starts in Exodus. So Moses is adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and he's going to grow up with a new name, a new identity. He goes to the best schools. It says in the books of Acts that Moses grew in wisdom and stature among all the universities of Egypt. And it's really cool because he's adopted. Moses was adopted. And adoption is on the heart of God. How do I know that? Because Jesus was also adopted. Remember his earthly father, Joseph the carpenter? Joseph adopted Jesus. In fact, in Ephesians 1, it says that when you trust Christ, you are adopted into God's family. And I love adoption. Our family has been touched 5 times over by adoption. Here's some pictures of my baby girls. That's my almost 7-year-old Ainsley, and then our surprise 7-month-old Alicia. And here's another picture of them with my wife Amber. And man, how cool is it to have more loved ones, to be part of a bigger story? And so if you are ever thinking about fostering or adoption and you've got questions, you're freaking out, I can't afford it, or man, come see me, come see any staff member. We would love to share with you how awesome it is to be part of someone else's story. Adoption is the story of Moses. It's the story of you and me when we follow God. So Exodus 2, Moses is adopted. Then there's a huge time jump in a single verse. It's like Marty McFly, go. 40 years pass by. Suddenly he's 40 years old. Moses has this sense of destiny, this sense of purpose. Like he was born to do something earth-shattering. So one day he looks out the window and he thinks he sees his moment. He sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew slave. So he tears off his Clark Kent. He goes, da, 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 da. He jumps in between and he goes, boom, like Mike Tyson. I'm going to take you out. Boom. One of my favorite leadership quotes comes from Mike Tyson. You know Mike Tyson, right? He's got the big tattoo. You've seen the movie, right? And one of my favorite quotes from Mike Tyson is this, that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. Great quote. And so, Moses, boom, lays the guy out, and he dies. Whoa. And so Moses is like, my bad, right? And he covers him up with some sand, that's what it says, right? And he's in stage left. And so then another day goes by, and he looks out the window again. I don't know if they had drapes. I just realized I did that. I don't know. So he looks outside and he sees two Hebrew slaves having a debate, arguing, and so he goes, bah, 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 Super Moses, and he jumps in and he says, excuse me, you two, and he mediates between them and helps work out the disagreement. And so don't miss this. Right away, what you see is Moses is standing up to the Egyptian superpowers, and he's a mediator of Hebrews. It's a foreshadowing of what's to come in Moses' life. But he's jumped at an opportunity that God didn't have for him because Pharaoh finds out about the dead Egyptian, and it's kind of like with those Netflix documentaries, hey, making a murderer, Moses. No. And so Moses suddenly is on the run. He's like, boo, roadrunner, baby, because there's a warrant out for his arrest. He's a murderer. Did you know that? Moses is a murderer. The guy, the Ten Commandments, let my people go. He's a murderer. They didn't tell you that in Sunday school class, did they, growing up? And that's just astonishing when you look at the Hero Hall of Fame in the scriptures. No perfect people allowed. Noah was a drunk. Moses was a murderer. David was sleeping around. Jeremiah was a manic depressive. So was Elijah. And Peter, don't even get me started about Peter. The people that God uses most greatly must first be crushed greatly. Peter. Right? Jesus' right-hand man on the way to the cross. Jesus says, you're going to deny me 3 times. Peter's like, no way, man. I got your back all the way. No, Jesus, nope. Don't know him. 3 times, right? And then Jesus forgives Peter at the resurrection because the person who was forgiven most has the most to say about forgiveness. Jesus allows Peter to give the world's first sermon about Jesus in Acts chapter 2. The most misfit, broken, messy women and men are whom God uses for miracles. So even though Moses blew it, even though he runs away from fame, fortune, he runs away from everything he knows in Egypt, he heads all the way east. He goes all the way, it says in the scriptures, to the land of Midian. This is an ancient map you can see. And he goes straight across Arabia, all the way to modern-day Saudi Arabia for 40 years of exile. Remember Star Wars, The Force Awakens? The search is for Luke Skywalker, and when they finally find him, he's like this old hermit, you know, get off my lawn, right? That's Moses. He's going to spend the next 40 years of his life, his prime years, all alone. No Wi-Fi, no AC, completely lonely. He feels like he's blown his shot at life. He feels like he's betrayed his family. He's a foreigner in a foreign land with foreign language. He marries a foreign woman named Zipporah, and he's working with sheep. He's like the guy who gets to be 80 years old and he's still sweeping the gym floor in your high school as the janitor. He's a shepherd, which is a low, low status job. He's running around for 40 years in the desert eating sheep dust. Feels like a loser. Feels all alone. And while he's wandering around in Midian, he gets married, he has a son, his son is born, and every time they name somebody in the Bible, it always means something. His firstborn is Gershom, which means stranger or sojourner. Because Moses felt like a stranger. He felt like, I have this vision for my life, and then somewhere along the lines, everything fell apart. And I don't even know who I am anymore. I'm just kind of wandering aimlessly. I've missed my big break. That's the story of Moses. 40 years. 40 Gershom years as a stranger in a strange land, shuffling around 9 to 5, depressed, lonely. And I would venture to guess that there's people in this space tonight who can relate. Who, like Moses, you feel like, man, I'm destined for something greater than this. There's something better than just going to school or, you know, working at that place. But man, I screwed up, you know? Like, there's Life Church skews young, right? And I know even in this space right now, there's a single young adult who's sitting there watching their friends get married and they're having children, and meanwhile, he or she's like 28 going, where's my Mr. Right? Where's my Mrs. Right? Wait, why am I so lonely? I feel like life's passing me by. Or maybe you've been betrayed, or you just feel, you know, like a stranger. That's Moses. That's Moses. And here's what we learn about Moses, and here's what you might learn in your story. The Gershom years are never wasted. There is always a purpose to the pain in your life. And what God does during that season in Moses' life is to prepare him for something greater. The Gershom years will lead to greater years. He's going to spend 40 years wandering in the desert eating sheep dust. But while he's doing that, he's learning the lay of the land. He's learning how to shepherd sheep, how to gather and keep people together. God always uses your wounded, crushing moments of loneliness in preparation for his purposes in your life. The man or woman that God will use greatly must first be crushed greatly. So my question to you is, if you feel lonely tonight, or if you feel like you've missed the boat, can you trust God during the Gershom years? 40 years. So one day the sheep go down to the peninsula and they end up at Mount Hebron, the mountain of God, also known as Mount Sinai. It's getting dark and there's a light in the distance. And Moses is 80 years old now, right? He's got dentures, his skin is sagging. He's ready to go to Florida. Well, I guess he's already at the beach, but he's ready to go to Florida, retire, and cash out. But he goes to this light and he sees this bush that is on fire, yet it's not consumed. It says that it's the angel of the Lord. It's a Christophany, an appearance of Christ. And it speaks to him. It says, Moses, this is holy ground. Take off your sandals. Because it's hot, hot, hot. So Moses listens, and it's God. And God says, Moses, now you're ready. Now you're ready for the greater things. And Moses is like, who me? I'm 80 years old. What are you talking about? I've missed out on everything. God says, no, I'm going to do something great through you. Exodus chapter 3, verse 24, the Israelites are enslaved, and I love this. It says that God heard their groans and their prayers. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. When you are most lonely and depressed, when you feel like you're misunderstood, don't miss these four statements about God's character and God's heart. God sees. God remembers. God hears. And God knows. You may feel far from God, but God is not far from you. If you feel like God is distant, you may have to look in the mirror and say, who's moved? Because God doesn't move. You're the one. And listen, you may not know where you are in your walk with God, but I know where God is in his walk with you. Our God is as close as the air you breathe. And don't miss this. Just side note, it says that God was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob was a deceiver. He was like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, always manipulating. He was a jerk, right? And then he gets turned into Israel, the good guy. But nowhere in Scripture does God say, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. No. He always brings up the past. He says, I'm the God of Jacob. And it's not a slam. It's saying, I am the God of misfits. I'm the God of losers and sinners. Because my love for you is not dependent on any way that you act or anything you say. It's not about religion. It's about relationship. And now God is drawing close to Moses, who feels like a complete loser. He says, I'm going to use you. You're going to go to Pharaoh, 80 years old. You're going to say, let my people go. You're going to lead them out of slavery. And Moses is like, no. He has five objections. He's got five things he's going to throw in the face of God. I mean, this is pretty audacious. When God calls you to something, you don't negotiate, right? Because that's pretty audacious. God could be like, I strike you down, right? So he's going to negotiate. He's going to give five excuses why you should not step into the purposes of God. Here's five objections. See if any of these ring true in your life. You might write these down. The first thing Moses says is, me, lead the people of God? Who am I? Who am I, God? You're calling me to make a difference in my neighborhood, on my campus, but who am I? I'm not smart enough, right? I'm not good looking. I have like 11 followers on Instagram. There's no way. Who am I? Exodus 3:11. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and demand that the slaves be let free? Who am I? Some of y'all are too comfortable. If you're comfortable in your faith, you're not doing it right. God never calls his people to a life of safety and comfort and predictability. Show me in the scriptures, right? Because Jesus says, no. If you want to follow me, you must take up your cross, deny yourself, and trust me every step of the way. See, Jesus always leads us to places where we are fully dependent on faith and not by sight. Who am I? Who am I? You want me to serve in your church? I don't have time. I don't have time to serve, right? I'm busy. Really? You're going to tell God you're too busy. You're going to tell God you can't serve 2 hours, right? Well, two Sundays a month, 1 hour here, 1 hour there. Well, that's just such a sacrifice. Really? You got better things to do on Sunday mornings than serve the Lord your God, who gave you oxygen, who gave you money, who gave you that relationship, who gave you that job, who gave you that reputation. You realize everything belongs to God. He's just letting you borrow it. You can't give two measly hours, just serve the least of these. Well, who am I? I can't work with the kids. Really? You can't push play? I can't work the lights and the sound. Really? You're playing your PS4 and you can't push the one button back there? Yeah, I can't greet people. I'm so shy. Come on, get over yourself. Jesus didn't save you to sit there. He called you to be part of a revolution. And if you can't serve, listen, save people, serve people. Oh, I'm going on a roll now because I'm touching somebody's nerve. Who am I? You are a child of the Most High. You're called to get up off your blessed assurance and make a difference for time and eternity. You can serve two stinking hours, right? I can't. Who am I? I can't give a dollar to the church because I need that money for gas. Oh, so you're going to put your faith in yourself instead of the God who gave you that automobile. You're going to trust what you can do with 100% when God says he loves to multiply. God can do more with your 90% than you can do with 100%. Who am I? That's a dangerous place to be. That's a dangerous objection. Second objection Moses says is, well, then who are you? Who are you? Oh, baby. This is one of the most famous sections of Scripture, y'all. This is where you get to know God in a very personal way. Moses goes, how are the people, 2 million people, they're not going to listen to me. I'm an old rotting corpse. What do I say? And God says, you go, ahem. You say, I am has sent me to you. I am who I am. And the rest of us go, say what? Which one, my Willis? Then God says, catch me outside. How about that? No. He says, I am who I am. So here's what it is. Write this down because this helps you understand. There's a difference between knowing somebody's like full name and then their personal name. So my name is Jonathan because my dad's is David, and I'm firstborn. So David and Jonathan were best friends in the Scriptures. My firstborn is Josiah. With every one of my kids' names, there's a reason for their name. So Josiah was the last godly king. Seth, you'll find out about Seth in a few minutes. And Levi. But the girls, Ainsley's not in the Bible, but there's a purpose behind her name. So listen, when you meet me, I'm like, hey, Jonathan. I always know when someone's new to the church. I'm like, hi, Pastor Jonathan. Well, hi, Plumber Joe. How are you? Hello, Secretary Stephen and airline attendant Betsy. No, I think it's silly, right? I'm just like, no. Call me John, right? That's when I know someone's been here more than once. When they're like, hey, what's up, John? Boom, right? And so God, right? God Almighty, he gets down. He says, listen, I'm a relational God. I've come to be with you. Here's who I am. Call me by my name. I am. And write this down, okay? The Hebrew verb for permanent existence is I am. I am the God of yesterday, today, and forever. He's no beginning, no end. Alpha and Omega, that's what I am means. Permanent existence. And in Hebrew, because this was written in Hebrew, it's there's no vowels. It's all consonants. That will drive me nuts on Wheel of Fortune. Show me E. It's YHWH, the unspeakable name of God. There's no vowels. It's just, it sounds like air, which is interesting because the Spirit of God, the Ruach in Hebrew, is air. Right? So, Yahweh, it's the personal. He's like, call me Yahweh, it sent you. And so people, Yahweh can also mean to be. When I hear to be, I think of Shakespeare. To be or not to be. And I start thinking of what if the scene between God and Moses was like a Hollywood scene and like movies? And I just start thinking like famous actors playing the part of God. I mean, could you imagine, you know, I am, and a famous actor like Jack Nicholson? You guys like Jack Nicholson? Tell them I am who I am! Jack, or Sylvester Stallone, I love me some rock. Yo, I am Andrea! Or it could be anybody. Donald Trump, I am. It just doesn't have the same weight as God just saying, Yahweh. And we sometimes get confused because people say Yahweh or say Jehovah. Some real quick history. So years and years and years after the time of Jesus, and the Jews are dispersed across the world from Israel, they're losing their accent, losing the Yiddish language. And so some well-meaning scholars take the YHWH and they add some little lines and some punctuation to help it roll off the tongue. And that's where the sound of the ah and the a come from with Yahweh. And then some folks who lost the Yiddish, the yah is more of a zh. In Yiddish, and so they would take the Yahweh and they go zhah, and then the H is a V sound, so Jehovah, 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 and that's why you may have a grandma, grandpa who says instead of Yahweh they say Jehovah, and they both mean the same thing. It's the personal name of God. And then some people, they freak out. They don't want to violate the fourth commandment, which is do not take God's name in vain. And so they won't say Yahweh. They won't say Jehovah. When they type online, they won't even write out God. They'll put G in space D because they don't want to use God's name in vain. And so they'll say in your English Bibles, the Lord, in all caps, the Lord. So when you see the Lord, it's the personal name of God. And some Hebrews would substitute the word Adonai, Adonai, which means my gracious master. So Adonai, the Lord, Jehovah, Yahweh, all the personal name of God, who's revealing himself to Moses, saying, I will be with you. I am. Well, Moses doesn't stop. He has another objection. Third objection is, what if no one believes that you have sent me? And he says, well, what do you got in your hand? And Moses is like, well, I got a shepherd's staff to protect the sheep. And he says, strike the ground, boom, and it turns into a snake. He's like, whoa, and boom, hits it again. It's a shepherd's staff. He says, this will be the miracle, signs and wonders. And it's so interesting as you read the Exodus narrative that this simple piece of wood eventually is named the staff of God, because our God transforms what's ordinary for extraordinary purposes. And that's what God does. He'll say, what have I put in your hands? What resources have I given you to make a difference? And really what God is leaning in to say to you and me tonight with our excuses and doubts is he says, won't you trust me to put your life in the gracious master's hands? Fourth objection from Moses. I'm not an eloquent speaker. I get an F in debate class, God. You don't want me up there speaking. I'm not good, and I love this. God's response is classic. In the Hebrew, it literally translates as, I will be with your mouth. That's awesome. I can't talk. Shut up. I can do anything. I love that. Don't ever bring your excuses to the almighty ruler of the universe, because he'll say, well, I'll be with your mouth too. And then the fifth and final objection of 80-year-old Moses is, send someone else. Is there anybody else who can go? Anybody at all? And then God gets mad. Oh, don't make me mad. You just made me mad. You're talking to me? And it says that the Lord's anger was starting to be kindled against Moses. He's not going to, like, you know, lightning bolt, boom, you're out of here. It's more like God's heart is grieved because Moses is refusing to participate in the miracle. God says, Moses, I have an awesome design for your life. Let's go on an adventure together. And Moses is like, but what if? God doesn't want your butt. Your butt is big, hairy, smelly. Leave your butt out of it. Because Jesus even says, let's go. We're going to change the world. Follow me. And the disciples are like, well, what's the plan? Do we have a budget for this? Jesus goes, no, just trust me. That's the way the Spirit moves. Don't send someone else. God can choose anyone. He plucks anyone out of obscurity. He can take a shepherd who's in his retirement years with no teeth and say, you are going to be a hero in history. That's what God does. He takes nobodies who will point to somebody in front of everybody. God doesn't call the qualified. He qualifies the called. He doesn't care about your report card. He doesn't care how popular you are, how powerful you are. God can use anybody, and he wants to use you. We got too many Moseses giving excuses, and God says, let's go. You're grieving my heart. You're missing out on this opportunity, throwing this pity party. Let's go, let's go, let's go. So Moses finally packs up. He goes, okay, we're going to Egypt. Hey, Zipporah. Hey, Gershom. Good news, guys. I'm going to show you where I grew up. I'm going to take you back where I went to school. It's going to be great. Let's pack it up. So they're traveling through the desert, and they stop one day to get a drink and, you know, use the bathroom and stuff. It's a long road trip. And while they're sitting there, you heard the story of the burning bush. Now, here's the story of the burning wife. Story of the burning wife. I love this story. It's just a small two sentences right at the end of this chapter. It says that when they stopped to rest, God was angry at Moses and came to kill him. So his wife Zipporah pulled out her switchblade. I'm going to cut you. She marched up to her firstborn son Gershom, cut off his foreskin, and dropped it at the feet of Moses. I missed that Sunday school class, and I'm so glad my Bible's not a pop-up book. Could you imagine? Whoa. So what's going on with the burning wife is this. It's simply this. Moses is going to lead a movement. There has to be integrity in the leader, right? If there's hypocrisy with the leader, this is why D.C. is a train wreck, no matter what political party. Don't give your money to political parties, by the way. You're just throwing money in the wind, right? What is happening is Moses, he lacks integrity. The word integrity comes from the root word integer, wholeness. Wholeness between what you say in public and what you do in private. So if publicly you're saying one thing and then privately you're taking pictures of your junk, people say you have no integrity. And that's what's going on with Moses. He's saying, we're God's people. We're the chosen ones. We're going to bless the world. And then his son was never circumcised. And that's the outward symbol of the faith. If the leader won't circumcise his son, ain't no way 2 million Jews are going to circumcise their kids. There's a lack of integrity. That's what makes God so angry at Moses, because Moses is about to completely just short-circuit this whole miracle, this whole movement of the promise, because he's putting his wife above his God. Zipporah was only half in. She was not fully into this religious stuff. And so he put the needs and wants of his wife Zipporah above his God. That's why God got angry. God is jealous for the affections of our hearts. Zipporah, she does the circumcision, and then she throws a pity party. She says, you go on to Egypt, you get this out of your system. I'm going to go back and stay with my dad. You come meet up with me in a couple chapters. Zipporah misses out on the miracle because she won't fully engage with the living God of the universe. She misses out on the Red Sea being parted and the 10 plagues. All these miracles that we're still talking about today, Zipporah misses out because she's half-hearted. Reminds me in Revelation when Jesus, he says, man, pick door number one or door number two. Either be all in or all out, hot or cold. Don't be just lukewarm. That's hypocritical. So, onward, Christian soldiers. Moses marches to Egypt. Let my people go. And Pharaoh died in no way. And so God is going to do 10 plagues. And here's what's really going on. The 10 plagues are Yahweh battling with the Egyptian gods. You go on the History Channel, you see the hieroglyphics. They had a pantheon of gods. And what Yahweh is doing is shining a light to the Egyptian people to say, I'm the only true God. The rest of these are false. They're fakes. They're made up. They're silly. Every plague is not just to afflict the Pharaoh. It's to reveal how awesome God is. Check this out. I love this. We're going to go through the 10 plagues really fast, right? First plague is the Nile turned to blood. The Nile is the centerpiece of the economy, right? Everything goes up and down the Nile. So when God turns it into blood, suddenly he's hit Wall Street. He's gone after their pocketbooks. God always goes after the money first, because money is always what's going to compete for the affections of our heart. That's why later Jesus, when he's teaching about God, he talks more about how to manage your money than he talks about heaven and hell combined. Because our money will always chase for the affections of our heart. So he turns the Nile into blood, and this is Yahweh striking down Isis and Apis, the Nile gods, and the guardian of the Nile's canoe, and he's saying, you guys are fake, I'm real. Well, if everything turns to blood, everything in the water is going to hop out. So plague number two is frogs. And not Kermit the Frog, guys. These are like frogs everywhere. And the Egyptians, they're finding frogs in the pot. They're finding frogs in the toilet. They're everywhere. And because they're superstitious, they're not allowed to kill the frogs. Frogs are everywhere. Baby crib, everything. And then it's the hot Egyptian desert sun until the frogs croak. Thank you. And they all die. And you've got these rotting corpses everywhere, which leads to plague number three, gnats. Gnats are everywhere. Moses strikes the dust, the sand, that turns into gnats. And this is Yahweh getting in the face of Seth, the god of chaos, the god of the desert. And my thirdborn, his name is Seth. And he looks nice, but he is the god of chaos. And he's no match for Yahweh. And so now you got small gnats, plague four is bigger gnats, flies. Infestation of flies clouding out the sun. It's horrible. The flies are God's way of sticking it to Ra and Uritchit, who are depicted as flies in Egyptian history. Then plague number five, this is the big one, death of the livestock. God is going to kill the cattle of just the Egyptians. He will spare the livestock of the Israelites to prove that God alone has power over death and life. And the cattle gods are Hathor and Apis. This is Yahweh declaring war on false idols. Plague six is boils. If you've ever had a boil, I have. It is horrible, and he afflicts the Egyptians head to foot with boils. The doctors aren't able to help them, and this is against the Egyptian gods of health, who are Sekhmet, Sunu, and Isis. Yahweh says, they can't help you. I alone have power over health. And then this leads to plague number seven, the hailstorm. Oh, hail no. Hailstorm is coming down. Nut is the sky goddess, who is no match for Yahweh. The eighth plague is the plague of locusts. And they're just everywhere, devouring, getting into everything. Osiris is the crop god. Seth is the storm god. And once again, Seth may look cuddly, but he raises a storm. And that leads to the ninth plague. It's getting darker because darkness falls over the land of Egypt. And you have to understand, they're in the desert. And so they see a lot of the sun. The sun god, Ra, is the head chief god of the Egyptians. You see this in the hieroglyphics to this day. And the pharaoh dresses, wears makeup like Ra. The pharaoh is worshipped as the sun god. And when Yahweh, the one true God, says, I will pour out darkness on the houses of Egyptians and daylight on the houses of my people, he demonstrates that Ra has no power. Yahweh alone can bring a light into the darkness. And this brings us to Exodus 12, verse 41, the 10th and final plague, the one that's most famous. And if you get this plague, you understand Jesus. So hang on to your sweet bippy. 430 years to the day when the family came down to Egypt, the family of Israel, 430 years to the day is the 10th plague. And that night, God will release 2 million to go back to the promised land. And what God does is he says, Moses, I saved my best for last. Warn the Hebrews, warn the Pharaoh, that tonight the angel of death will visit the land of Egypt, and I will extinguish the life of the firstborn of every family and of every animal. And the only escape route is me. And you ask, what's the escape route? God says, Hebrews, take out a lamb, an unblemished lamb, and sacrifice it, because the blood represents life. As long as you have blood, you're alive. The blood that's spilt is death. There must be a sacrifice for the death plague that's about to befall. And God says, take the lamb's blood. There's this elaborate ceremony. The bonus study notes on our website, lifechurchmichigan.com, go into detail. I don't have time to go into it, but it's so interesting. He says, go to every door, go to every doorpost in the Israelite huts. And they were short people. They didn't get calcium. So they were small people, but he said, go to the doors to take the lamb's blood and put the blood over the entryway to all the homes, all over the doors. And the blood is dripping down. It smells. It's messy. It's very gory. There's nothing sexy about animal blood all over your home. Could you imagine if it was prom night or homecoming and the kid shows up and you take him all around, you know? There's just blood dripping everywhere. And this is so important because this final plague, the angel of death, is going to visit, extinguish the lives of the firstborn unless the blood is over the doorway to your house. And then the angel of death will pass over where the blood of the lamb is displayed. Are you connecting the dots? Are you seeing how the Hebrew traditions and religion all points to Jesus, who on the night of his arrest gathered his 12 friends together in the upper room and celebrated the Passover meal, a yearly annual ritual where they eat the bitter herbs to represent the bitterness of slavery. They have unleavened bread, bread that's not even, you know, it's like to go. It's worse than McDonald's. It's really bad for you. And they've got their bags packed by the door. And they sacrifice the lamb. And at the end of the Last Supper, Jesus said, all of this that you've been celebrating for centuries, the Passover, the Cedar meal, it all has been pointing to me. It's all been pointing to me. He has the four cups. He holds up the cup of God's judgment, God's wrath. And he says, I drink of this cup. And he goes to the cross. Jesus is the only perfect person. So he's the perfect substitute, the perfect lamb of God. And his blood is spilt. And so if the blood of the lamb is on the doorway of your heart, you are spared the death penalty. Are you tracking with me? What's going on here? Jesus fulfills the religion so he can usher in a relationship with an intimate God, Yahweh. And so the Passover happens. Moses leads the people out in darkness. Not only 2 million Israelites, but it says a multitude of Egyptians also went because they got it. They realize, wow, Yahweh is awesome and he is real. These Egyptians is a joke. And Moses, he could have taken the easy route in the darkness. He could have gone straight east, the northern route, a couple weeks, he would hit Canaan. But God leads him by the power of the Holy Spirit down into the desert to the Red Sea. And these are desert dwellers. They don't like water. And now their backs are against the wall. They've hit water, and the chariots, the superpower, the army, the Pharaoh himself are coming down on God's people. And don't miss this. This is what God does in our lives, people. If you're trying to make sense of why things have gone haywire in your relationships, if you're trying to understand, why did I lose this job? Why am I so bitter? Why am I so angry at the world? This is why God purposefully will lead you to a place where your back is against the wall, where you're up against overwhelming odds, where you're destined to fail unless God intervenes on your behalf. That's exactly what God does. Moses, strike with the shepherd's staff. The waters part. 2 million walk along dry land. It's a miracle that thousands of years later, we still talk about. Then he says, hit the ground again. The waters crash down on the superpower of their day. The Egyptian chariots, the soldiers, the Pharaoh himself are swallowed up by the water. And in that moment, God's people see that God is mighty to save. He is a rescuer. He is a redeemer. He takes the slaves and makes them free. Yahweh is exalting himself above all the pretenders of Egypt. And he simply says, trust me, follow me. They go a little bit longer, and end, our story tonight ends with Exodus 15, where they say, let's stop for a breather, people. Let's set up camp. And they're like, oh, wow, all this stuff happened. Did you see that? Yeah, I took a selfie there, and that was so crazy when that happened. Oh, my goodness, wow. And they break out in worship. Because when you've seen something amazing, when you go see the fireworks on July 4th, you're like, ooh, ah. You're going, wow, you're in awe, right? When you see God move in your life, when you see God rescue you, when you see God save you, you can't help but ascribe worth to him and say, he must increase, I must decrease. That's what worship is, ascribing worth. And it says in Exodus 15, they do two things. One, they give an offering to God. They say, wow, God, we want to do something amazing. And so they collect, right? And it's all an act of worship. Giving, generosity is an act of worship, right? And then they break out in song. Moses, he beats it. You know, he's like, it's better than Coachella. He's like, yo, God is amazing. Take it from his sister and his older sister, Miriam. She's the world's first worship leader in the scriptures. And she sings this beautiful song to God in Exodus 15. Because worship is what we're made for. We're made to focus on something other than ourselves. And when you realize that his name is Jesus, Yeshua, which sounds so much like Yahweh, because they're one and the same. The Son of God, sent by the Father in the power of the Spirit, on a rescue mission to set God's people free by spilling his blood on the doorway of our hearts and by trusting Christ to forgive and to lead, we get to experience the miracle in our lives.